Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we'll finally delve into the world of Frank Zappa. Some of our listeners have been asking for this show for years.
Yep.
And fortunately for them, Alex Winter released his great documentary, Zappa, last year. But first, we've got some new music to review.
That is a little bit of a song called I Feel Alive by Viagra Boys from their new album, their second, Welfare Jazz. Greg, I first discovered Viagra Boys as a buried treasure. They formed in 2015 in Stockholm, Sweden. Two tattoo artists, Henrik Hokert and Sebastian Murphy. Murphy was born in San Francisco, but ended up living in Stockholm. They went out for a night of drinking that ended in a karaoke bar where Murphy was belting out a song by Mariah Carey. The two gentlemen said, then and there, we must form a band. They started out with two EPs. The first album, 2018, Street Worms, really caught my attention. What are they giving us on their second album? It's more ambitious than the first, not to tip my hand. Let's play a song. We'll come back and we'll do our reviews. This is the opening track on Welfare Jazz, the first of 13 songs. It's called Ain't Nice by Viagra Boys. You can have me.
That is Ain't Nice from Viagra Boys. The new album is called Welfare Jazz. Ain't Nice. No, he ain't, Jim.
That is the character he portrays. Yes.
Yes. Sebastian Murphy playing in full character here, embodying this creep, this sleazebag who goes through life ruining lives, including his own.
First and foremost, his own.
I think the closest parallel that I can think of in contemporary music to what Sebastian Murphy is doing in this persona that he is building on Viagra Boys' record is something like the early records of The Weeknd. You go, how can anybody have sympathy for this guy? He sounds like an absolute creep, right? He's an abusive person. The one thing that was redeeming about The Weeknd was, in fact, he owned up to it. And in the same way, I think Sebastian Murphy points the finger as much at himself as anybody else. I am this person. I don't like it. I'm close to the bottom, as he said. One song, Into the Sun, where he goes, "What kind of person have I become?
What kind of person have I become? The ghost of an outlaw who was captured at home."
He's questioning this relationship that he has built for himself with the world, with his lover, and realizing that much of what's bad about it is because of him. At the same time, there's sort of a sleaziness about the record, a swagger to the record. You almost feel creepy about liking it, you know?
No. Only if you would feel creepy about liking Nick Cave, Grinder Man, or the Stooges.
He's a despicable person. He plays a despicable person. But what I like about the record, the sound is intoxicating. I love the way that skronky saxophone sort of... twines around that slurry, blurry voice. It's almost like the saxophone and Sebastian Murphy's voice are the one and the same thing on this record. It's a very much of a package deal. So when he sounds drunk and staggering and wayward, the sound embodies that. You know, the track Girls and Boys, where he just breaks into this gibberish. I love that. I mean,
yeah,
I think it's just...
Speaking in tongues.
It is an intense record. It plays as humorous and almost satirical at times. But at the same time, there's a sadness and a despair at the bottom of it as well. And I didn't think I would like this record nearly as much as I do, but I do like this record. Primarily because it really questions what it means to be a human being. You know, there's no black and white.
Yeah.
There's that big gray middle. And is this guy a good guy or a bad guy? And you're trying to figure it out through the entire album.
Let me enlighten you. I think there's a level you're missing, or you need to dig a little deeper. I mean, you can get thrown with a stupid band name like Viagra Boys, okay? What I think Murphy is singing about is a question that I think me and you and Andrew Gill and every thinking male white cis fan of rock and roll is asking himself in 2021. Can I like, you know, the Rolling Stones or the Stooges or Nick Cave at his bad seediest and Grinder Man records, right? Can I love that raw masculine energy and not fall prey to toxic masculinity? Can I not be a jerk and a bonehead but be male, right? It's a very male record. but at the same time, it is skewering racism, classism, toxic masculinity, misogyny, with the same energy that Idols is, Greg. You know, not for nothing does the record build to an end with a cover of In Spite of Ourselves by the great John Prine, where Murphy is duetting with Amy Taylor of Amyl and the Sniffers, another band I first fell in love with as a buried treasure.
In spite of ourselves, we'll end up sitting on a rainbow. Against all odds, honey, we're the big door prize.
I do think it's satirical. And look, the problem with satire is it can be misunderstood. You can hear his drunken boorishness as a celebration of that, or you can hear it as what I think it is, a condemnation, a satire, a looking at yourself in the mirror and saying, I don't want to be that guy, but there are times when I become that guy.
Well, but you're ignoring the idea that he's walking that line. You could go either way on this guy, and I don't think it's nearly as clear-cut as you're making it seem. Do you have thoughts on Viagra Boys' latest? Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, and let us know what you think.
Oh, yeah, that is a little bit of Valley Girl, Frank Zappa's highest charting single, his sole collaboration with his daughter, Moon. And the reason, the only reason many people even know the name Frank Zappa, if that's all you know, then you really don't know much about Zappa. Greg, I think it's a subject we've avoided for a long time, despite listeners often saying, when are you going to get to Frank Zappa? Because it is such a complicated musical legacy. Well, the day's arrived. Today we dig in and try to give a more accurate picture of Zappa as well as our own insights into that vast discography.
Absolutely, Jim. It's a daunting and complex legacy. We're going to be talking with director Alex Winter in a little bit, and his documentary is an excellent entree into Zappa's career. But let's start with the facts of Zappa's life before we get there. He was born in Baltimore in 1940. His dad was a chemist employed by the defense industry, so the family moved around a lot when Zappa, Frank Zappa, was young. And they ended up in California working near a chemical plant, and that required the family to have gas masks in the house. So when Frank Zappa was a young kid, he's growing up in a house with gas masks, you know, and you can imagine how that might have affected young Frank as a person. Drawn to music at an early age, I mean, he was listening to avant-garde classical music as a kid and being entranced by it. He was writing orchestral music before he started writing rock and roll. He didn't even start writing rock and roll songs until he was in his 20s. But he loves classical, he loved composing, and he figured the easiest way to get my compositions heard is to form a band. Just like any kid in California in the 60s probably, you know, they were thinking, hey, I can do this too. That meeting with Captain Beefheart, Don Van Vliet, must have been something, huh, Jim?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, Van Vliet was a lover of the blues who understood the what Brian Eno later called the idiot energy of those garage band nuggets records, you know, Louie and all of those tunes, which Zappa, you know, disdained, right? From the beginning, his first band, the Mothers of Invention, he was going to take the contrarian point of view. Famously, the Mothers put out a record called We're Only In It for the Money, parodying the cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. You know, the Beatles were about art. No, not the Mothers. They were about money, right? Zappa was always going to take the opposite view, whether it was a rock and roll garage band or the ambitious artistic undertaking of Sgt. Pepper's. He was going to go in a different direction. And early on, he was a record company executive, too. Mm-hmm. You know, when he met Captain Beefheart, he not only championed Beefheart's weirdness, he started two labels distributed by Warner Brothers, mm-hmm. right? Bizarre and Straight. And Frank Zappa celebrates promotes the early music by Captain Beefheart, by Alice Cooper, by the GTOs, a group of what was then self-proclaimed groupies, women mm-hmm. who followed rock stars, and Wild Man Fisher. You know, Zappa was early into the outsider artist thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the fact that he was championing these artists and was one himself, somehow subverting the music industry from within. I mean, he was being championed or at least financed by these labels and creating these art records that were incredibly subversive, both on a musical level and a lyrical level. I mean, the guy was doing everything from blues and rock. He started out doing some bluesy stuff, as you'd mentioned, and going into classical, avant-garde, and jazz music very early on and mixing
doo-wop.
Up genres.
Doo-wop, everything. He loved doo-wop.
He was a true student of music, loved many different types and styles of music, released countless records, multiple albums almost every year of his life, yet as a serious composer who indulged in, let's face it, juvenile humor, you know, virtuoso guitarist who sometimes didn't play the guitar at all on many of his albums, a prolific recording artist more celebrated in some ways for taking on Tipper Gore in those Senate hearings on explicit lyrics than for his music.
You know, died early, Greg, 52 years old mm-hmm. in December 1993, leaving behind dozens and dozens and dozens of albums in dozens of styles. And I think one of the reasons we've always been slow to get to the Zappa legacy is where do you even tell people to start? And how do you deal with the thornier problems of Frank? Well, we're going to try to answer the question of how you get people to start. I think Alex Winter's new documentary, Zappa, is a good place to start. It really gets into what made Zappa tick and why his music still matters today. And then we'll come back and give more of our thoughts on this complicated musical genius. That's all in a minute on Sound Opinions.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
All good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know when you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis, and we're digging into Frank Zappa's life and music. The reason we're doing this episode now is that excellent documentary, Zappa, that was released late last year. And we should acknowledge up front that the director, Alex Winter, is also an actor, best known for his role as Bill in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Now, we didn't mention that claim to fame in this interview. Well, almost didn't mention it.
Alex, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I got to tell you, before we get into talking about Frank, a million years ago when I started this show, I'll tell you how long ago it was, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure was new. New in theaters. And my partner was Bill Wyman, and we seriously considered for 10 seconds calling the show Bill and Jim's Excellent Opinions.
That's
just
great.
Think excellent. Of all the royalties you could have been collecting, Alex. I mean, it was incredible.
It would have
that.
Been excellent. Yeah. Obviously, Zappa is a labor of love. The film is so in-depth and covers this incredibly, it's a daunting career. Tell us how it started.
Well, I was coming off a pretty dark tech-oriented doc I've been on for some time, and it was immersive, and I was looking to do something that was more, had a bit more levity and out of the tech space and into an area that maybe was more culturally broad. And my producer and I were quite curious as to why no one had made a Zappa doc, like a thorough, in-depth examination of his life and his relationship to the times and his relationship to his art. And I got to Gail Zappa and I pitched her the take, and she really liked the take. I think it was uncommon for her, for people to come at her with something that wasn't looking at Frank as a rock and roll 70s icon, you know, which is really not my interest at all. And we hit it off. And then she gave us access to the vault, full access, which really changed the course of everything, because A, it allowed us to make a much more comprehensive film, but it also required us, once I saw the vault, I realized that a lot of the stuff I wanted, sort of more rare film material, was in disrepair or in danger of deterioration. So we kind of hit pause on the doc and spent 2 years, raised quite a bit of money through Kickstarter, and then spent about 2 years with my team preserving all that endangered media. And that was a mammoth undertaking, and very satisfying, but took us some time. And we came out the other end of that with a lot of material to make the film with.
Okay. This aisle here is where some of the best-known titles lurk. Here's stuff from the Hot Rats. Here's the original 24-track, Masters of Dynamo Hum, Dirty Love, Montana, Inca Roads, Redunzel. Shut Up and Play Your Guitar, Joe's Garage, or Shake Your Booty.
Alex, so you said the 70s rock star documentary didn't interest you. What was it that you were kind of hoping to portray here?
You know, my induction to Frank in the 70s was as much as a pop culture icon as it was a rock musician. I mean, he was kind of like a Richard Pryor or George Carlin as much as he was a rock hero to my social group.
And this gentleman plays perhaps the strangest of them all. He plays the bicycle, and his name is Frank Zappa.
Thank you. You actually play a bicycle?
Yeah.
Are you in the Musicians Union?
No.
Do you play any other musical instrument, anything more conventional, perhaps?
Guitar, vibes, bass, and drums.
Guitar, vibes, bass, drums, and bicycle.
And then as I got to know him more, I got into Zappa's music mostly after college when it dawned on me that he wasn't really a rock and roll musician at all, that he was really more of an avant-garde composer who was using different genres and tropes in order to make his work. And even the humor, I realized it felt more like he would use humor the way an avant-garde composer would use percussion, you know, in some very offhand way to elicit a kind of response.
He's a fascinating figure, and you can't really pigeonhole him, although people obviously tried. To somebody who's coming to Zappa with a sort of, as Jim said, this sort of daunting sense of, my God, where do you start with this guy? Where would you point them?
Yeah, if they really just want to know his music, I would give them Hot Rats and the Yellow Shark and just say, listen to both of those. And if you want to keep listening, then you're in good shape.
Hot Rats!
Were you worried, given the loyalty of that Zappa following, were you worried that no matter what take you took, avant-garde composer, rocker, Mothers of Invention fan, right? Somebody's got to be offended, right?
Yeah, but that's very liberating, frankly, because I was so sure that no matter what I did, I would offend someone. I just didn't worry about offending anyone.
That's great.
We just got along and told the story that we wanted to tell. I wasn't going to make a legacy doc. We were telling a very particular story about this man that was driven mostly by his interior emotional life. And for me, I was interested in where he was in his life at various points in his career and conveying that through his, you know, the personal and intimate aspects of who he was.
Mm-hmm. Do you think he was a happy man, Alex? Because much of the film, you don't spare the difficulties that he caused other people, other musicians. Mm. He was uncompromising. He was singular in his vision. Some people would say that made him an a-hole. Many people do. You quote some of them.
In the 4 years I was with Frank, he shook my hand once and said, good job. I don't ever remember Frank embracing somebody.
He was difficult, you know, and you don't spare that.
No, and it's one of the things about him that I liked, because it's human. He's a human being, and I knew that it wasn't one-sided. I'm drawn to documentary characters that aren't one-sided, that have multiple layers to them that are valid, and he was a family man, and he was a philanderer. He was a martinet. And he was very collaborative. He was all of these contrasts. And that's a great doc subject, because that really gives you a full picture of the strangeness and multifaceted nature of humans. And Zappa is an extreme example of those things. But, you know, even when I was interviewing artists who had worked with him who had very contentious experiences, you know, there wasn't one of them who didn't well up thinking about how moving their experiences with him had been and how important they were in their lives, not for reasons of fame. And they sure as hell weren't for financial reasons, because no one was making lots of money. It was because they were so profoundly important years in their life in terms of his ability and desire to really pull the best out of people and find their inner best, as it were.
Frank would often appear to be cold, aloof, and not personally involved with his trained monkeys, as once he joked about, we're just all trained monkeys, right? He's the circus ringleader or whatever. But I want to tell you that he had great feelings for us. He was human. There were times when I didn't feel that he was so much, and I did feel he was cruel at times, but he was a passionate man, and he developed real love. I'm not going to say equally for everybody, but the people that he loved, he kept bringing back over and through many of the bands, many of the tours.
It's fascinating to me that you were able to explore some of these areas. You weren't sugarcoating it at all. And obviously the Zappa family and the estate, famously protective of his legacy, but it seemed like they gave you the leeway to go into these areas and tell the truth without sugarcoating it. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, well, I had Final Cut. You know, I don't abuse that privilege, but I certainly maintain it. And I told Gail from the very outset, and she had passed before we even started making the doc, which was tragic and unexpected. We knew she had cancer, but we thought she was going to live quite a bit longer. I told her at the very beginning that the film was going to be warts and all, and that this wasn't going to be a glossy portrait or kind of a superficial legacy movie, but would really dig into all aspects of who he was. I just said I would do that intelligently and respectfully, but I wasn't going to sugarcoat it.
Mm-hmm. Did anything that you found about Zappa's life surprise you?
Yeah, I mean, there was so much media, I was surprised on a daily basis, to be honest with you. I mean, there was literally not a day that went by where we weren't finding some extraordinary thing that we didn't know about. The one that I was most taken by that had, thankfully, a lot of footage to correspond with it was how much time Frank spent in the 80s and going into the early 90s before his death, traveling around the world and visiting other countries like Russia, and getting a sense of how their economics work, how their cultural aspects work.
I arranged to come to Prague on my way back to the United States from Moscow. And it was during my Prague visit, I proposed to them that if they needed some sort of representation in the West to help them get investment or whatever they needed to do, that I would be interested in doing that.
And he wasn't doing this publicly. He wasn't like a cultural ambassador like we have now, like an influencer or like someone who's traveling to these, you know, to an African country with 15 camera people following them everywhere. He did this on his own without any noise at all, out of legitimate curiosity. And I found that really inspiring.
Yeah, when you see people like Vaclav Havel embracing him, you know, famously the Velvet Revolution, right, for the Velvet Underground, but Zappa was the other big hero. You know, this music was that inspiring.
Yeah, it really was. And that was very moving for him, I think, especially, you know, he wasn't doing so well commercially in the U.S. at that time. And the world had gotten very corporatized, and we were in the middle of the Reagan era, and things were pretty grim, and then into the Bush era. And I think that was a moment for him of affirmation that his art and the struggles that he had put himself through had meaning for people.
I'm sure you already know it, but this is just the beginning of your new future in this country. And I hope that your new future will be very perfect, very perfect.
The battle with the censors in the 80s, too, he was the face of that in many ways for the, you know, the counterculture. And that was another thing that I found incredibly powerful about him, was that he was one of the artists who was willing to go up to the seat of power in America and confront these people about what they were saying about this music. And you could see kernels of that early in his life, that he was sort of a rebel and didn't cotton to authority in any way. But it's a big step going from that to, you know, doing this as an adult and putting a suit on and you know, dealing with these people who were making these accusations. Did you get any sense of why he was so driven to take that extra step. Instead of just sort of complaining about it from the sidelines, he took that extra step to sort of be, you know, at the forefront of that.
There was a real direct line for me from having grown up around the post-war kind of military community in Maryland where he was born and spent his early years, to the fights he had as a youth in California ending with his imprisonment on complete bogus charges of entrapment. There's a direct line from that young Zappa to the Zappa in middle age who's fighting like hell to maintain his artistic career, going to battle for a bunch of music artists who don't even show up to fight their own, mm-hmm. you know, their own censorship fight, and ending up taking, you know, as you said, the extra step of actually putting everything on the line in a degree and putting on a suit and going face to face in battle with forces that he'd really been up against his entire life. Mm-hmm. But by then had certainly had achieved enough fame and had earned enough money to sidestep all of that if he had so desired. But I think, you know, these were very impactful and important early life events that really made a huge imprint on him. And I don't think he was about to take that lying down. I really don't.
I was surprised to see you heading the protest. Why wasn't someone like Prince involved with you in that? I mean,
he should have been involved in it, but I think that it's his right to keep his mouth shut. It's also Bruce Springsteen's right to keep his mouth shut, and anybody else that they went after. They never attacked my lyrics. They attacked those people. They even went after Michael Jackson.
But you fought real hard for these people, and it was never your music involved. That's the thing that shocked me.
It's the principle of the thing. We live in a country where we're supposed to be free. Take a look at what happened in China. You got a bunch of kids there who want democracy. They don't even know what it is. We supposedly have it here. What do? Sit around and go, let somebody else take care of it for me.
You know, his humor, I think, was a big part of what he was doing as well. Some people would call it smutty, you know, explicit. You know, but a line struck me. You got a great line early on in the movie where he was sort of describing himself, it seemed. If you could make someone laugh, that was good. If you could make life more colorful, then that was good. It seemed to be like a summing up in some ways of how we approach things. I mean, do you think that's accurate?
I do, which is why I put it in. I had always had a theory, which again is personal, but I feel is somewhat borne out by that quote, that Zappa was using humor the way an avant-garde composer would use weird household objects as instruments. You know, the way Varese would play with weird sirens and horns. You know, I've met a lot of people who really couldn't get into Zappa because they thought the music was great, but then he's got to go and do these goofy lyrics. Mm-hmm. I think the way in for me was Zappa. The real aha moment I had was that it's just music. It's just another thing to elicit a response, to either elicit a laugh or to make you feel good, or it's no different than the emotional response he wants to get from the more, you know, conventional musical forms he's playing with. To me, the humor was a musical conceit more than seeing himself as like a Tom Lehrer or someone who was a straight up satirist.
Yeah, or a Lenny Bruce. It might be more broad. The film ends near the end of Zappa's life with him seeing his music performed by an orchestra in Europe. You know, so 25 years down the road, Alex, what do you think the legacy is going to be? Is it going to be, you know, Joe's Garage and the rock albums? Is it going to be our orchestra is going to turn it? Because it's not like there's a big Edgar Varese revival. You know what I mean? It's like, I think most people only remember that name today because Zappa said it all the time. But, you know, is it going to be like Karlheinz Stockhausen or any of these difficult avant-garde classical composers?
I think that he is more embraced by the classical community than he is by the popular music community or, you know, the rock community specifically. I mean, I know we got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and all that posthumously, but I think he's, you know, he's beloved for, as you said, I think there's like Joe's Garage, Apostrophe, Overnight Sensation. I think there's like a core group of albums that people kind of will hold on to is Zappa's classic rock albums, as it were. But there's so much more to him than that. And that is such a tiny slice of who he is that anyone who scratches that surface will immediately go, oh, wait a minute. This is like a little period in a vast catalog. And I think that the general understanding of Zappa as an artist is more as a classical artist than as a rock or popular musician.
You know, when he talks about the page black with notes, I used to remember
black
that as
page,
a fledgling piano student. You know, you would look at the page and you just go, there is no way I'll ever be able to play that. Zappa was prone to that sort of thing, where he would constantly be challenging himself with this very complicated music and then telling other musicians to play it. And if they didn't play it the way he heard it in his head, there was hell to pay for everybody involved. It's an interesting dynamic. There's a perfectionist streak there that seemed to be like, was he ever fulfilled by anything he ever did? I wonder if you got a sense of that at all, you know?
I do. I think that there's a lot of footage I have of him either in rehearsal or in performance where there is just a look of sheer bliss on his face. And funnily enough, sometimes that isn't even when someone is doing something that he himself has written. So he has a vision and he works to see that vision realized. But all of the artists that really truly came out of Zappa's stable, like Ruth, like Napoleon Brock, like Steve Vai, like Bozio, Adrian Belew, I mean, these are all artists that can more than hold their own without a conductor standing over their shoulders. And that's what Zappa liked about them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see Vai go completely off and Frank is watching it. He's making sure it's staying within the confines of whatever the songs are playing, but he's certainly not all over it. And I like that contradiction. There's a division between the Zappa that's controlling everything and the Zappa that's part of a big collective that's just kind of taking off, you know, in a artistic way and a way that has proficiency. You know, he didn't want to mess, but it's still taking off.
Well, and to a man and woman, all the musicians you mentioned all considered it like it wasn't even a master's degree. You were getting your PhD when you played with Zappa.
For sure. Yeah, you were at your best, but he helped you get to your best. Mm-hmm. You know, he was very, very good at that. And the artists that worked with him really liked that aspect of it, that they knew they would come away much better than they had started.
The driving force seemed to be make music that no one else is making, be totally original, which I guess is an impossible goal, but it seems like that was it, right?
Yeah, and I think that he really believed in music or the art being more than the sum of its parts. I think, again, for someone who was viewed historically as being kind of this lone genius in his ivory tower, he was extremely collaborative and communal and had a very specific swarm of people around him that he was working with at any given time or just communing with at any given time. And I think he was always interested in making something that was more than the sum of its parts that could really cut. I think that's why he was so excited by having the Ensemble Moderne, finally having musicians around him that could play the orchestral music at the level that he wanted, because he couldn't just do it on the synclavier. He couldn't just do it on his own. You know, he needed that sort of communal energy to make it work. And that's why The Yellow Shark is such an incredible album.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
We have been talking to Alex Winter, the director of Zappa, a serious documentary, just like his earlier films, The Panama Papers and Trust Machine, The Story of Blockchain. Seems like, Alex, you were struggling first to save the modern world from itself, and now trying to explain one of the most difficult artists in the history of popular music. And in between, you're Bill.
Well, I need a mental break.
I got you, brother. Thank you so much for coming on Sound Opinions.
Yeah, it was really great to be here. Thanks, you guys.
You bet.
Thanks, Alex.
Have you seen Alex Winter's documentary on Zappa? Let us know your thoughts. Record a message at our website, soundopinions.org. When we come back, we'll share our takes on Frank Zappa. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Cott. He's Jim DeRogatis, and we're reckoning with Frank Zappa this week. We just spoke with director Alex Winter about his documentary on Zappa, but now it's time for us to share our opinions on Zappa as critics. Now, I know, Jim, that I'm more vocally in support of Zappa's music than you are, so I'm going to start us off. You know, I've got problems with Zappa's music, too. There's so much of it, and there's a lot of it that, you know, frankly, I think is not great. I don't necessarily want to listen to it. But there's incredible amount of stuff in there that is fantastic, that makes the case that we are talking about certainly one of the most important and misunderstood musical figures of the last half century.
Well, genius is an overused word, but the guy, I think, qualifies. I mean, his intellect and his musical virtuosity and his ambition, yeah, I can't think of many people more deserving of the word genius than Zappa.
Well, you know, and I think sometimes people who sort of don't dig in to Zappa, you know, figure they have to be in on the joke to appreciate his music. You know, there is a certain element of humor and satire there that can be daunting on top of the fact that the music is incredibly complex in some cases. And he does have a rep for smutty humor, you know, a penchant for being politically incorrect at times. He's also got a deadly serious side. And that's, I think, something that people don't realize. Early on, he was a musical subversive, not just an outspoken musician and composer, but as a social critic as well. He was cutting against the grain of everything that was going on in the 60s. We mentioned earlier, We're Only in It for the Money, right? That parody of the Beatles album. Here we are in the middle of the flower power era, peace and love, man. And Zappa was going, you guys are nuts, man. All you're just trying to profit off this stuff, you know?
No, it's a con.
You
it's
know,
a con.
Exactly.
The hippie thing is a con.
And that was not exactly a popular sentiment to be sharing at that time, you know?
Not until Charles Manson woke people up.
Right. You know? But Zappa got there first. Then later on, obviously, lashing out against Tipper Gore, he became the spokesman. Not that he volunteered for the role, but he was so incensed by the idea that the government was in some way going to repress free speech in a creative enterprise that he spoke up about it in Congress.
Incredible eloquence, and at that point, he's an independent artist. I mean, it's long since the Warner Brothers days, and you know, he could have suffered serious repercussions. He's literally living on every album sold, and it's a small cult following to begin with. So he put his money where his mouth is.
Exactly, and nonetheless, he was able to build a following and build a career, but it was on his terms every step of the way. There was no compromise in what he did. I want to go back to the debut album, album of the Mothers of Invention from 1966, Freak Out. And Zappa early on was exhibiting this side where he was a serious social commentator. Very early on, he was speaking out against racism in America. He was speaking out against things like, you know, redistricting in Los Angeles, where, you know, blacks were confined to a certain part of the city and they couldn't live in the white neighborhoods. I mean, this was like a blatant disregard for human rights. On that debut album, he had a song called Trouble Every Day, which he re-recorded several times throughout his career. It was the first of several songs explicitly talking about racism. This one in particular was inspired, if that's the correct word for it, after watching news coverage of the Watts riots. And he eviscerates everything in this song. The socially restrictive housing that I was talking about in Los Angeles, police violence against men of color, the media coverage of those events, and the fact that the American dream just isn't the same for everyone. There's a verse in this song where he talks about, and if a million more agree, there ain't no great society, the reference to the LBJ great society, and it applies to you and me. Our country isn't free. Again, these were very powerful sentiments to be pushing out in a time of incredible division in our country. We talked about earlier about his roots in the blues. This is a pretty straightforward blues song, very garagey punk blues, similar to the early Beefheart stuff as well. He would move beyond that in subsequent versions of this song. There would be horns and a more elaborate arrangements, but this raw early version always gets to me. It's Trouble Every Day from the Mothers of Invention on Sound Opinions.
You know, we got to sit around at home and watch this thing begin. But I bet there won't be many live to see it really end. Cause a fire in the street ain't like a fire in the heart. And in the eyes of all these people, don't you know that this could start on any street in any town, in any state, if any clown decides that now's the time to fight for some ideal he thinks is right. And if a million more agree, there ain't no great society as it applies to you and me. Our country isn't free, and the law refused to see if all that you can ever be is just a lousy janitor. And unless your uncle owns the store, you know that five and every four just won't amount to nothing more than to watch the rats go across the floor and make up songs about being poor. Blow your harmonica, son.
Trouble Every Day by the Mothers of Invention. Yeah, I'm with you on that tune, Greg.
It's a great track. It holds up very well. And as I said, it was the first of many in that vein that maybe he doesn't get enough credit for writing. I want to showcase a different side of Zappa as a composer, the classical composer in Zappa, coming out in this amazing instrumental from the Hot Rats album in 1969. Here he is using that 16-track equipment in a recording studio, you know, manipulating the tape speed, doing incredible overdubs, fully realizing the possibilities of the studio and this 3.5-minute instrumental composition. There's only four people playing on this track: Zappa, Ina Underwood, Shuggie Otis on bass, Ron Sullico on drums. It sounds like an orchestra in that studio. Ina Underwood was the secret weapon on a lot of Zappa's recordings, the woodwinds player and also keyboard player. It's so layered, so majestic. You know, at about the 150 mark, it just sounds so incredibly powerful. It's like a king marching into the town square. You know, it's so regal and so powerful and so majestic sounding. The way Ian Underwood's woodwinds are layered in this song, I think it's one of his most beautiful compositions, one of his most insistently melodic, and one of the most complex at the same time. It's Peaches and Regalia from Frank Zappa's Hot Rats album on Sound Opinions.
Peaches and Regalia. Yeah, another great track. Greg, I think we could spend 4 or 5 hours just highlighting a couple dozen great tracks from that vast legacy of Zappa. But if we're going to step back and deal with him as an artist, as the entire canon, and where he fits in the musical spectrum, there are some really difficult things we have to grapple with. I became aware of Zappa and began my Zappa odyssey in two ways. Number one, this guy was constantly being referenced in Modern Drummer when the young 13-year-old Jim is trying to learn how to play drums, right? As the author of The Black Page. Now, The Black Page shows up on a bunch of recordings and live concerts. Two versions of it, 96 on Lather and 1983 on Baby Snakes. This was a piece Zappa wrote for drummers and percussionists as a, I dare you to try to play this. I also was drawn to Weasels Ripped My Flesh from 1970. When you're 13, when you're 14, you read, this is the nastiest noise ever recorded. You're just like, ooh, 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 yeah, I got to hear that. I think around 16, 17, I was in a band with an older guitarist who was, you know, very sophisticated, you know, 2 or 3 years older than me, and he smoked and he played guitar and he was like, oh, Zappa, Zappa, Zappa. So, you know, I'm listening to Joe's Garage, which is coming out at that point. It's a triple album, three-act rock opera about a censorious overseer trying to stamp out the life of a young artist who happens to be in a garage rock band. Yeah, you know, that appeals to you at 16, okay? I'm basically a sophomore in high school, and the sophomoric humor is about where I'm at on my developmental scale. And so ends my Zappa fascination until years later when I'm writing my first book, The History of Psychedelia. How do I deal with this guy, right? I read the telephone book size doorstop analysis of Zappa's career, Frank Zappa, The Negative Dialectics of Poodle Play by Ben Watson. I've never read a denser music book.
Yeah.
And I'm listening deep and I'm understanding, I'm digging the guitar albums. I am liking the classical music. You know, Zappa could fall prey to, I've got a new toy and I'm going to abuse it. I'm sorry, Jazz from Hell, Francesco Zappa, Thing Fish, those albums are dreadful. You know, he has this new fancy digital synthesizer and he's just making music that like belongs in the easy listening category, except it's more complicated. My biggest problem though, Greg, my biggest consistent problem is how this brilliant man, this well-read philosopher and intellect, could consistently love the crudest, cruelest, most misogynistic, I'm going to bait the women's libbers. That's how it starts in the 60s. And then it just becomes pure misogyny by the 70s and 80s and beyond. A man who is clearly not racist, speaking out eloquently against racism, but doing a sort of Amos and Andy kind of parody at times, asking his black vocalists to portray caricatures and stereotypes. You know, I go back now to Joe's Garage and Catholic Girls. You know, when I was a sophomore in Catholic high school, I kind of dug, you know, him making fun of pedophile priests and Catholic girls. And now I'm like, this is just so offensive, it is unlistenable. You know, and on top of everything else on Joe's Garage, he appears on the cover in blackface.
I think that's the one thing about Zappa that is least understandable. Like, an incredibly smart guy. And I'm with you, the sniggering, you know, teenager, and you found it, you know, funny, you know, and he obviously thought it was funny. And, you know, it isn't. Plain and simple.
No, it's a stumbling block, I think, Greg. I think he is more appreciated in places where people don't speak English.
Yeah.
And don't have to listen to the twaddle that's coming out of his mouth.
Well, because he was a great musician. I mean,
the
compositions were incredible in a lot of ways. And as he titled one of his box set albums, Shut Up and Play Your Guitar. You know,
yeah, shut up, Frank.
Shut up and play your guitar, Frank.
Greg, we could talk for hours about Zappa. Frankly, I'm glad we're not going to, though, because I've been listening so much to it. I'm just trying to make sure. Jim, did you miss something in the Illinois Enema Bandit? No, I didn't. I don't think. But anyway, that's the conversation starter. We are always happy to hear from our listeners who disagree, and I'm sure we will get some Zappa fans who do. Meanwhile, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we have an interview with the great director, John Carpenter, about his burgeoning musical career.
For more sound opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor at soundopinions.org. That's sponsor at soundopinions.org.
Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions was produced by Andrew Gill and Alex Claiborne.